is going on, everyone? Welcome to episode 2 of the Analysis Paralysis Podcast. We are bringing you something a little bit different this time. We're not going to be doing, you know, a topic or talking about recent plays or anything like that. No, today I am joined by 3 Mataini Sharks, is what I'm sure they would love for me to call them. And we're going to be deep diving Mataini, a game by Carl Chudiak. So today I am joined by Daniel.
Hey there.
And John.
Hi, happy to be here.
And finally, last but not least, Max.
How's it going?
So yeah, we have a great panel of guests here today to break down this game, really get into the weeds with this one. This is something that I would love to continue to do as long as I can find people who are passionate about these games and want to talk about them in depth and really, really live up to the name and get some paralysis with this analysis, if you know what I'm saying. So I do want to throw this to John real quick so he can give us a little bit of an overview of Mataini. I'm sure that many of you are familiar if you're curious enough to be listening to a podcast that's literally all about this game. But just in case you need a refresher or you're just checking this out of curiosity, John, why don't you give us a little bit of an overview of this game?
Sure. I'll do my best to make a short and sweet summary of the game, and you guys can just chime in if I miss anything. It's a complicated one, but thematically, each player in the game is meant to be a monk or an acolyte in a Buddhist temple, and you're trying to build the most successful temple by creating works of arts that you put in the temple gallery to display or into the gift shop to sell to visitors. And the way you do this is by using a deck of 54 cards, all unique, multi-use cards that can be used to take actions that will improve either your hand of cards or your temple in a variety of ways. And each action that you take is also shared with your opponents. So the game is really all about effectively choosing and manipulating when you choose those actions and those cards to give yourself an advantage and hopefully not give too much benefit to the other players. And every card in the deck has a unique special effect, but those only trigger when the card is made into a work that you put into one of those two wings that I mentioned, the gallery or the gift shop. And the game ends the moment one player puts a fifth work into one of those two wings of their temple. And then at that point, they don't win by putting the fifth work into a wing. That just triggers the game end. And then everyone scores points for the works they've created, goods they've sold, which are obviously cards that can be used for goods, among other things. And then also certain additional cards in your hand if you've sold the most goods of that particular type. So I think we can get into some of the details and the nuances of what that means. I don't want to bog it down, but I think in a nutshell, I'd say the game it's a race game that's focused on hand management. And maybe when we get a little bit further on, we can talk about what that means and some of the specifics.
Yeah, absolutely. And I do want to ask for you all, I think that was a great overview. How did you become aware of this game? Like, what attracted you to it? You know, is it something where you had games like Mataini that you liked, and so someone maybe put you onto this game? Was it just out of the blue? But I want to throw it to Daniel. Why don't you tell us where you found this game, how you found it, and kind of your first experiences with it?
So I don't remember exactly where I heard about Mataini, but it was right around, I think it was May of 2020, right around like, you know, peak lockdown COVID sort of thing. And I heard about this game and how it was just very similar to Glory to Rome, but it was like really tight and a compact experience. And I looked into it. It was in stock on Amazon. I bought a copy. I had nobody to play with, but I just like two-handed solo played the game, sat down one day and played it. And I did not understand it at all. Just completely bounced off it. I was just like, what am I doing? And it probably took me a solid like 90 minutes just sitting there with the rule book and the cards and just moving them from one side of the table to the other to sort of almost crack this nut. And then I did sort of get a decent understanding of it. And then like the other two here, probably once the game became available to play online, that's when my appreciation really took off. But that's my history with the game.
What about you, Max? How did you come to find this game?
Through Ludology, Mike Fitzgerald, when he was one of the hosts, was a big fan, was always talking about it. So sometime like 2018, 2019, I heard about it on there and, got it, played it, I don't know, 15, 20 times with my wife. And then didn't play it for 2 years or so until it went on, Yukata. And then I think it went live like the week before a vacation and I played it over 100 times that first week. And just like became completely, absorbed into, just how intricate the flow of the cards is and how much I still am learning stuff, you know, hundreds of games later, I'm still like, oh, this little like, subtlety in how the different suits interact will like draw me back in again.
It's so interesting to hear the different ways that people have found this one. What about you, John? How did you find it?
Yeah, I think probably a similar time frame to Daniel and Max. I think before this one, I had found and become pretty hooked on Innovation by Carl Chudik, and that's, you know, I would at that time and even now I'd say is my favorite game. And I think through that, I'd heard about Glory to Rome, which is probably his most famous game. I think for a lot of folks, it's kind of this grail game that's very hard to come by. And, you know, I didn't have any access to that one, but I'd heard about this as maybe an iteration on it or an evolution of it. And I think maybe you and I might have tried it early on around the same time together. And I think we both had the first, you know, initial response of, what is this? This is strange. I don't know if I like it or not. And it felt very different from Innovation. And I think like Daniel, I went home and started playing, you know, I bought a copy of it and there's no way my wife was going to play it with me. So I just started playing it against myself a little bit to get the flow and the rhythm of the game. And something about it, you know, kept me coming back, even though those first, you know, handful, even dozen plays, I didn't really know what I thought of it. And then, yeah, like Max and Daniel, you know, went online and I started playing games, you know, and just got hooked on it. I think, you know, Max and I played a bunch of games, sort of a series of them. He organized some tournaments and, you know, a couple hundred games of it later, it's one of my all-time favorite games. And yeah, it's just one of those things that kind of gets in your head. And like Max said, I feel like every time I play it or I go on a stretch of playing it, I notice something new about it. And that's what I really kept coming back for is that discovery.
Yeah, absolutely. And yes, I do remember those initial plays. It's so interesting to me to be on this side of things now where we kind of found it at the same time, or at least started playing it at the same time. And I think I came out of it deeply appreciating the game at the time, at least. I still appreciate it, but maybe not being super hot on it. And I think you were the same, but for you, just continuing to explore it and see the nuances and that creating this deep, you know, love even of the game has been really interesting to see for sure. And I will put a massive disclaimer on this really this whole episode, but anything that I say, because of this group of four lovely gentlemen, I am by far the least experienced resident neophyte. And I mean, greater number of plays that these individuals have over me is quite astounding. So I'll mostly be playing color commentary and just trying to direct the conversation, but I'm so excited to talk more about this game with you all and kind of break it down because seemingly it's worthy of that type of discussion. And that kind of segues perfectly into kind of this first segment. You know, why is this game worthy of a deep dive in the first place? Clearly we all think it is, otherwise we wouldn't be recording this. So, you know, clearly there's something here, something to discover, something to grow in skill with. But I just wanted to kind of open up the floor there and ask why you think it's worth playing and discussing. So I'll throw it to Max. What do you think it is about this game that, I mean, you maybe highlighted a little bit of those things when you talked about how you found it, but to go into a bit more detail, why is this worth our time?
So for me, one of the big things is how much is packed into a 54 card deck. And then you've got a couple pieces of cardstock for your player mats. I tried to tot up the number of states or uses of cards, and I got to 13. So there's 54 cards. They're all unique, five suits. But each card has the potential to be in 13 different states as, you know, a work or supporting your hand or supporting your craft bench or a helper, whatnot. And so there's just so many permutations, like, you know, the odds of getting a particular poker hand are so low, and this has that and then more because every card has all of these unique powers and the interactions between those powers. So there's just so much going on in such a small package that it's really easy to, you know, memorize the cards and become very familiar with the deck because it's so small, but there's just so much game to explore within the confines of that deck.
Yeah, and I think I would add also one of the things that I love about the game and I think makes it unique is the playtime, you know, the ratio of playtime to depth. You know, I think it's a rare thing to have a game that feels sort of like this endlessly deep pool you can just dive into and never find the bottom of, but the games can play in, you know, 15, 20, 30 minutes. I mean, it's a 15 to 30 minute game, you know, when you're playing with two people. And so once you get into it, you can play it a lot and feel like there's always more to discover, even hundreds of plays later.
One of the things that really, I think that these games, the reason why they're worth coming back to over and over again, and so I'm coming to this from more of a Glory to Rome background, I guess, but they're very similar games. I think we might touch on that later, but the multiple facets of interaction is what keeps bringing me back every time. It has sort of the task or action selection mechanism that is reminiscent of Puerto Rico or A Race for the Galaxy, or probably the two most popular games that feature this, where you will pick one action to execute, and then everyone will do either that action or some version of it. And then so a large part of the game is trying to make it to where the actions you select are more efficient for you than for your opponent, or your opponents, as the case may be. And that's sort of one large, you know, piece of the, or like, you know, a slice of the pie, the interaction pie. But then also there's the floor, which is one of the states that Max mentioned for where cards might be at any given point. And the floor is sort of a holding area for where cards can be for a moment before they can get scooped up into one of, I don't know, maybe three other areas, say. I'm not sure that's right, but somewhere around there. And like you, whenever you remove cards from the floor, either by pushing them into your storeroom or, you know, whatever, you are both grabbing them for your benefit, but you're also making it to where your opponent can't grab them. And that sort of, you know, floor control, I guess, is what I would call it, is just a really interesting aspect of the game to me. How you have this sort of shared space that will inform your decisions, and you know, to Max's point earlier, you're presented every game with a different, like, you know, layout of the game state, and so you have to be, you know, thinking constantly, like, you know, what action should I take? But you have so much influence on what that looks like for the next player, and that's what keeps bringing me back.
Yeah. The way that the cards interact seems to be so varied, which is incredibly impressive for the minimalism of the design. And I think for me, once again, as the neophyte, the presentation actually brings me into the game, how seemingly the theme actually kind of works. And there's always that discussion around another Chudia game like Innovation, you know, how much theme is actually there. And you know, I won't get into the weeds of that, but with this one, I think it's neat that it is about kind of using everything at your disposal and not wasting. And that ethos or that idea permeates through the design and how it's, like Max said, just 54 cards and a couple pieces of cardstock. And it's so impressive the level of gameplay that Chudiak was able to get out of that amount of components. It's similar to, I haven't played Glory to Rome, but I get that impression with that as well. Like it being mostly a card game, and also especially with something like Innovation too. So maybe that's part of it too, is it comes from a designer who's shown that he does a lot with very little. And whether or not you end up liking his designs, some people might find them a bit chaotic or abrupt or sharp. But I think, and what we will talk about is that's actually the reason why it's so compelling, is because there's so many different interactions of cards and a lot of sharp points of interaction and some passive aggression even, and all manner of things. But I do want to drill down on the interaction a little bit more. I think there's been some brief mention on the layers that are there in terms of how you interact with the other player or players. But I'll just kind of open the floor, pun intended, to anyone who wants to talk about, like, what are the different kind of layers of interaction in this game, and how do you find those compelling? How do those affect the decision space and things like that?
Yeah, something on that subject actually was coming to me as we were talking about it, because, you know, we keep comparing to innovation, and I don't want to get too bogged down on that comparison. But I think the thing that's interesting to me about Matai and I is that for a game that doesn't always feel as aggressive or as confrontational as, you know, innovation or maybe some other card games, there's almost nothing, I would say maybe there is nothing you can do in the game that doesn't involve interaction with your opponent. Every single action you take in the game is interacting with your opponent. You're either choosing a task that's going to give them some sort of benefit, putting a card into play that's going to affect what they can do or what you can do relative to them. Even no task, even the single thing you can do where you're not choosing to take a task is deliberately denying them the ability to get a bonus. So, you know, it's a game that I didn't appreciate right off the bat how interactive it was, but the more I played it, the more I realized it's as interactive a game as I think I've ever played, because there's nothing that doesn't play off of the other players in the game and your opponent. And you have to constantly take that into account with every choice you make, which, you know, I love interactive games. I like games where you can't ignore the other person. And this is, that's the entire game here.
The interaction seems incredibly, I mean, just core to the game, to be certain.
One thing that I'm curious about, John and Max, is what points of interaction do you think popped out to you more after your first 50 plays or whatever? Because for me, I'll give you my example, but I'm really curious to hear yours. Mine is that the composition of your hand is, like, weirdly a really strong form of interaction in that. So one of the things that John mentioned earlier is that there's, like, several ways to score points once the game ends. And one of them is this concept of back orders. And briefly, back orders is if you have more sales, and sales is one of the card states that cards can be in the various suits, than your opponent, then you get points for any of those cards of that suit left in your hand at the end of the game. And the game ends immediately when one of those in-game conditions are triggered. And your hand is your hand at that point. And so what I found is that there were times when I was thinking, oh, you know, my opponent definitely wants to end the game ASAP. They definitely have a really powerful board. They think they're winning, but I'm just going to try and stuff my hand with really valuable cards and say, come on, bring it on. Let's just see what we got. And that was something that, you know, maybe some people figured out in the first 10 games. I certainly didn't. And it was just one of those things that really jumped out to me after my first 30 games. I'm curious if you guys have any corollaries there, or, you know, things like that.
Well, I'll have to think about that a little, because I think that's a great question. But I think on that point, the idea of the jockeying around back orders, you know, I don't know how many games in before that really, the nuance of that became apparent to me. But I think it's a really fun and interesting part of the game. And I think a lot of that comes down to the way the turn structure is set up. So you have this hard hand limit of five that you can never change, but you don't discard down to five cards until the start of your turn. So like you were saying, you can deliberately try to disincentivize your opponent from ending the game when they seem like they're ahead on points on what's on the board. But if you've managed to draw a number of cards into your hand, you could have 7, 8, 9 cards in your hand. And because you don't discard down until the beginning of your turn, you know, you're discouraging them from ending the game when you know you're probably behind. You can bluff around that. But at the same time, because the deck is so small, there's only 54 cards, and, you know, the breakdown of each suit is, it's pretty easy to learn. You can look at what's out there on the floor, on, you know, on people's temple mat and works, and you can have a sense of, well, how many of a particular suit, you know, could he have, or how many, you know, do I have of what's out there? So I think that's a, you know, that part of the game probably didn't jump out at me until I was pretty deep into a lot of plays as well. So I think that's a great observation.
Yeah, I think that's an interesting question. I think for me, one of the big ones is just the mind games and the second guessing and the, you're almost bluffing when you do certain things. So you always want to have, you know, cards in hand that you can smith if your opponent plays a smith. And so there's like a Princess Bride scenario where I'm going to play a card that lets me craft another card. So I'm down to three in my hand, and am I bluffing that I don't have something good that I can smith? Do I have something really good and I want my opponent to smith, and I'm like trying to goad them into playing that type of card, or that suit, so that I can, you know, like, aha, even though I only had two cards left in my hand, I have a card that lets me smith with only having one cloth in hand, and I smith tapestry and I get 5 points. So there's this just something very simple, like doing something that gets you down to having, you know, two cards in your hand is a mind game almost, especially if you played with someone multiple times and you kind of know their strategies and you know, like, oh, he's passed four times in a row. That's not normal for him. He's trying to jar me, or he's trying to shuriken me or frog me or something. Like, there's an element of just, even if someone's not doing anything, they're just passing. It's like, why is he passing? What card does he have? Or is he trying to pull out? Or what bluff is he trying to play? And so just five or six turns where both people pass every time is like, I'm like, you know, on the edge of my chair, biting my nails, like, what's going to happen? Who's going to break first? Who has the better, you know, hand that they've managed to build over these last couple of turns? Even though we didn't do anything for five turns, it's still tense and I'm still like waiting with bated breath.
Yeah, you just segued us perfectly, because the tension in the game, right? There seems to be plenty of axes of tension-filled moments. So I'm curious, for whoever wants to jump in, what are some of those tense moments? You know, you talked about a little bit of the doublethink, but I'm sure there's other elements that create a tension to the game. So if you want to highlight some of those, like, go ahead.
Sure. And actually, it's funny, because I think this goes back to something you and I talked about way back when we first tried the game, Thomas. But I think a lot of the tension comes from the way the game is a race to five works. And so, you know, a lot of that can come from who has the ability to end the game on their terms and on their turn. And one of the things we didn't mention is that in a tie game, the tiebreaker goes to the active player or whoever's closest to the active player. So if you can end the game on your turn and you know that you're tied on points, you win the game. So controlling the timing by the ability to, once someone has three works in a wing, you know, if they have the ability to make more than one work and complete it, then, you know, all of a sudden the game is on a knife edge. And I think when we first tried it, Thomas, it felt a little abrupt because of how quick the game was and how quickly it could end. And I didn't appreciate right off the bat. It sort of felt like the arc wasn't as satisfying as some games that run a little bit longer. And then I think over time, as I played it more and more, that tension started to appeal to me and made it, you know, as or more satisfying than a much longer game, because I knew from almost the first few turns that the game was on that knife edge. And so it became a lot more interesting to me once I appreciated that.
Yeah, I remember feeling very dissatisfied with the arc of the game and played it some more, and that kind of subsided. But still, there was this feeling of like just the tempo that was involved. And I think a lot of that's an experience. And I don't know, I do know that I don't now have the experience to say that I've rectified that or feel maybe even differently. Once again, I deeply respect this design. I think it's incredibly impressive. But I think part of that too was that prayer action, just the not playing a task, right? Which is the prayer, right? Like just not adding a task that turn. Is that correct? Okay.
Yeah. For folks that don't know what that means, it's probably worth saying that that's essentially letting you draw a card. So when you don't take a task, you get to draw a card. So that's what it means to take a prayer in the context of the game.
But yes, I remember feeling very dissatisfied with that, where inaction was seemingly rewarded. But there's actually something that I've started to appreciate about that in games, where it's not just, hey, what action am I going to take? What's optimal in this moment? If I'm considering the variables that are in play and considering the other players, but maybe sometimes even the lack of doing something is a decision. And that's very interesting, because the game seemingly is so much about tempo that you have a bit more control over how fast or slow you do what you're trying to do is, I think, just another lever to pull in the game, where some games perhaps lack that. You're locked into the same turn structure every time, and you're going to have to take an action. And sometimes that's great in games where you wish you could pass, but you just can't. And you would love to have that release valve, but the designer didn't put that in for a reason, because they don't want to release that tension. But somehow it's seemingly in this game that lack of action doesn't release the tension. It maintains it. And so that's a very interesting piece of the design, for sure.
Going back to the length of the game and that abrupt feeling, I think a lot of that has to do with expectations, especially if you came from Race for the Galaxy. It has some of the trappings of an engine builder, and in an engine builder, you get to build an engine and then you get to run it. Here, you could have an engine building type game where it lasts long enough that you can actually use your helpers or your craft bench multiple times. But often you will get a great setup and, you know, I have two covered monk helpers and the game just ends before I get to play that monk and get my five actions in one turn that I spent, you know, four actions building up to having a mega turn, and the game ends and I don't get to do that. But I think that's an expectation of this looks kind of like an engine builder, so I expect it to play similarly, but it doesn't. It's not really an engine builder. I don't know. How do you guys feel about that? Like the engine buildingness of it.
I definitely agree, and I think that the expectations do maybe not hold the game back, but keep it from being as popular as I would expect it to be. Like Glory to Rome, for example, the other game that's very similar to this, definitely has more of that engine builder goodness, right? Where you can, like, you know, build the building that lets you refill your hand every time you build more buildings, and then you build some more buildings and refill your hand, and you just keep going to town, and then you get all the points, whatever. Cool. When I look on BoardGameGeek or Reddit or whatever, and like, you know, see what people have to say about these two games, Glory to Rome and Double Tainai, there's like definitely the people who really love Multainai, but there's also a lot of people who, like, it's clear they just bounced off it and then never came back. And then I don't think Multainai is that much harder to learn or to play than Glory to Rome. Maybe tell me if you think I'm wrong there, but I like, there are differences, but there are corollaries between the two rule sets. It's like hard for me to go back and try and figure out which one's harder now, but I don't think that there's a large significant difference, right, in the rules overhead. But I think it's that like, you know, clash of expectations, like, you know, people feel like if they're having to put maybe all of this sort of, like, you know, mental effort into figuring out the 13 ways in which these cards can move around for a game that can be over in 10 to 15 minutes, you know, maybe it's just not worth it. But I think it is. But like, you know, maybe that sort of class of expectations is what puts a lot of people off on this game.
Yeah. And I think, Thomas, to your point before, and maybe again, it's a bit of that expectation aspect of, you know, not taking a task, essentially passing and drawing a card. You know, I think sometimes that in some games can feel like a wasted turn, like you're not accomplishing anything. And I think it takes a few plays, or, you know, for me, it took more than a few plays to come to appreciate that is a very tactical choice. It is interacting because I'm denying the other player something that they may want to do based on what they have on their board. You know, I know that they can take advantage of a certain task I might otherwise want. And so instead I choose to not take a task, draw a card, give myself better options, and then potentially, you know, draft off of whatever they do. My personality is I like to try and do something. I like to move the game forward. I like to try to make things happen. So it took me a long time to, you know, overcome that. And even then, you know, if we pass back and forth a bunch of times, I find myself getting antsy, even though I know that it's not always a good idea. And Max has beaten me many times because I can't help but take a task or an action that he's, you know, waiting with the exact right hand to take advantage of. But I think to something he said earlier, part of it is when you are passing and the other player passes and it goes back and forth, instead of feeling like the game stalls out, I think now I appreciate the tension that's coming, because as you learn what's out there and what can be done, suddenly you start to get more and more nervous that the longer I go, you know, without doing something, even though I'm denying this person an action, he could be building up something, you know, that's going to end the game, or that's going to cost me, or that's going to put him in a big advantage. So I think it took me a while to realize that too, but that might've just been, you know, because my expectations are that you want to do something on your turn rather than no task.
As far as the kind of depth that we see in this game, I think we've highlighted a lot of the aspects that add such depth here, but just want to open the floor again for discussing maybe some elements that at first you didn't realize would add to the depth of this title, but as you're playing, you're noticing, like, maybe share some of the revelatory moments, some of the mile markers as you've been playing that made you think differently about the game, opened up a new possibility that you didn't realize was there before. We'll get in some of the strategic weeds later in the episode, and I will give full permission to get lost in that, but maybe highlight some of the kind of those milestone moments, if you would.
Well, I'll give an example. I think for me, it took me a while to realize just how heavily focused the game is on hand management and what that meant in terms of, you know, when to give up on a particular strategy and when to pivot to something new, because you have this hard 5-card limit on your hand size. Sometimes it's tempting to try and keep all these great cards that you really want, because, you know, if you can get them into play, they're going to be devastating. But the game is so short and there's so little margin for error that if you don't, you know, if you wait too long before you realize that you're not going to get those cards into play, and you don't curate your hand by discarding and drawing new cards or doing something, it'll be over before you ever have a chance to use them. And so I think it took me a while, but then I realized, how you had to really quickly evaluate when and if a card that, you know, in one game might be super powerful is just not going to be useful in this game, given the context of what's on the board, what's in your hand, you know, how quickly you think you'll actually be able to make use of it. And sometimes you just have to jettison it and, you know, pivot to something that, you know, in a different game would have not been nearly as good. And I think that context of, you know, knowing which cards are good from game to game and which cards you have to, you know, let go, even though you really want to make use of them, you know, just comes from the hand management aspect of it that I really appreciate. It makes you take constantly difficult decisions about which cards to keep and which cards you can hold on to.
It's not just the sort of, like, you know, which cards also, it's also, you know, how much you're keeping back, which is what really gets to me lately. I think, you know, sort of where I'm at strategically, which is way behind John and Max, I'm pretty sure, but I keep opening games and seeing all the opportunities out in front of me and, like, oh, I'm going to grab this, you know, Smith Helper off the floor, and then I'm going to build these two cards, and then, wow, like, I am way ahead of my opponent. And then I'll have one card in hand and my opponent has 5. And then I just feel like I've completely lost at that point because they're doing cool stuff now. And I'm, like, not doing cool stuff, emphatically not doing cool stuff. And it ties back to that tension aspect that we talked about. It ties back to that concept of the sort of, like, you know, passing and the sort of, like, you know, old Western, like, you know, showdown sort of thing where you can just keep staring at each other and drawing cards. And I am just not in the headspace for that. I just want to play out my cards and do my cool stuff. It's just not even like, you know, which of these cards do I deploy and which of them do I try and shuffle down to the bottom of the deck? It's the pacing, right? Like you can't, you know, get all your cards out of your hand too fast, because the cards in your hand represent both the works you can deploy later, but also the options you have for what actions to use.
Well, and I think it's an interesting comparison to the game of Glory to Rome too, which I know you've played a lot more than me, but I think Glory to Rome is a bit more generous in the way it keeps the cards flowing into your hand. It's much easier to refill your hand and to have options from turn to turn, whereas Matainai, it's easy to get stuck with very few cards, and then you maybe can only draw one card per turn and you just fall way behind and the game's over. So, you know, it makes you value every card, you know, very highly and put a lot of weight onto what you pick. And I do think, you know, one of the things it took me a little while to realize is that opening hand, when you look at it, you may have three or four or five really cool paths you think you can take based on the cards that are there, but you're going to be lucky to take one of them. And you might just have to try to identify that at the outset and then go for it. And if that doesn't work, you know, a couple turns in because you're just not drawing the right cards to support it, or they're doing something that denies you it, then okay, you got to pivot. Maybe you go a different direction.
Yeah, I think that's really probably where my struggle is, because so in this game, like we said before, the sort of default draw card action is called pray, or a prayer. I'm not sure what the exact verbiage is, but let's call it pray. And then when you pray, you draw one card. It's always one card. You might have multiple pray actions you can queue up and execute, but each pray action is one card. Whereas in Glories of Rome, the default draw action is think. And when you think, you can draw back up to your hand size, which is super powerful. But also, I think you're just like, you know, a smack on there. That draw action thinking really rewards you for having deployed all your cards, right? Like if you can get value out of four cards and then think and draw four more cards, you're way ahead of somebody else who played one card, got value out of that, and then used their think action to draw one card. And that is completely different in a Matainai. It's, you know, maybe it's back to that thematic, like, you know, squeeze every bit of value, do not waste. I don't know. But you're right. That's just very different. And it's much less about card velocity and much more about just, you know, being very careful, right, with your cards.
So we've mentioned this prayer action, and for me, I'd say that's maybe the closest thing to a con of the game for me, just personally. And I'm not even putting forth any type of judgment on the game, but I am curious for you personally, what are some possible flaws, even in a game that clearly you all love or at least like a lot, but also maybe more relevantly or more interestingly to those listening, what are some potential flaws that you think could be there for those coming to this game fresh or anything like that? Because clearly this is something that you all enjoy, and so it's maybe harder to drill down on those things you don't like. Maybe there's nothing you don't like, but what are the potential flaws that you see in a game like Matainai?
Well, I'll start and folks can jump in, but yeah, and well, I should preface it by saying it's one of my favorite games. So, and, you know, to my taste, it's just about flawless, but I mean, I think what it does have is something that, you know, is a pro or a con depending on your outlook, but there's a pretty high skill ceiling. And I think you can have, as a result of that, a really big skill gap. So if you have someone who's more experienced and familiar with the cards that are in the deck, and you have someone who's new to it, I think it's a big advantage because, you know, there's not as many, you know, quote unquote, take that sort of card effects that you might find in a game like Innovation or other games. But knowing what's out there, there are certain cards that are, you know, very powerful and can swing the game. And if you don't know that those are there, you can put yourself in a position where basically the game is over very quickly. So it does, you know, like any card game, there is luck to what you're drawing. And I think it doesn't happen very often because there's so many ways to mitigate it in terms of the actions you take. But there will be a game, you know, now and then where you just, it's the perfect storm. You know, the other person, they open with a hand of everything they need to win within a couple turns. And, you know, when that happens, that's just sort of, I tip my cap and say, okay, I love that possibility is there and let's run it back. Let's play again. But I think for some people that's going to be, you know, frustrating.
Yeah. I think a lot of the cons of trying to get into this game sort of go back to that clash of expectations. Like the game is sold in a filler weight packaging. It's a 54 card filler size game. The length is filler length, but this is not a filler weight game in terms of, you know, strategic depth or even sort of that first level, like figuring out how to make lethal game actions. It takes a little bit, you know, to get the rule set internalized. And I think that, you know, one of the cons might be just in, like, you know, today's board game hobby where, you know, people have a lot of games they want to play and they want to, you know, just like you experience a lot of stuff. They might not see the value in like, you know, spending that time on something that appears so small. And yeah, the skill gap or the high skill ceiling, just makes it harder for people like, you know, me and John and Max and so on to, you know, teach our friends, right? Like if I were to, you know, grab my wife tomorrow and say, hey, let's play this card game. It'd probably be 10 minutes before she'd say, can we go back to playing Haggis? Because it just probably would not. I mean, like, you know, where do you start?
It's maybe not as immediately apparent in how one does well, and maybe not as immediately understandable, perhaps. You know, I think that's what you're getting at. And I think there's value in that, you know, in something being approachable if you're wanting to show it to people. But I guess often the price of admission for a game of this depth that I think you would all say that it possesses is usually that it's not going to be in its best form when just showing a person just casually, right? You almost have to prepare them for what you're about to play. You got to practice the teach a little bit because it's a little wonky. You know, I think you're right, Daniel, that it's not like it gets a weird rap for the teach and for the way to approach it. I do think, but I will say there are some just wonky bits to that teach. I've done it before, and just trying to get the idea to someone that there's all these different ways that you can use a card is very hard to wrap your mind around, and you have to kind of see it in play. But thankfully, right, this game is rather short, and so you can kind of get those reps in. So that's kind of the redeeming factor. But yeah, I just figured I'd add that as well.
Yeah, for what it's worth, for anybody who was considering teaching this to a friend, the best luck that I've had with teaching it is not doing like a, you know, sit down and let's have a teach. It's essentially, you know, the briefest overview and then deal out hands and just say, on your turn, pick a card at random and let's just see what happens. Like, let's just, you know, see where the cards flow. Because it's one of those things where I think you can really sort of learn it by just, you know, moving the pieces around and seeing the patterns more than you can trying to learn the rule set. So I would recommend that if anybody's trying to learn this game, just, you know, just see what happens.
I think one thing that's helped me teach is doing, I think I saw this on BGG, but doing a couple turns or a whole game where you ignore the uniqueness of the cards and you just treat them, you know, all cards of the same suit is the same, just to understand the flow of the cards from your hand to the task, to the floor, back to your temple mat or as a work, without getting bogged down in like, wait, what does this card do? What does this card do? So you're just sort of learning the structure. And luckily it's so short, you can do that in, you know, 10, 15 minutes, play till everyone, you know, till somebody gets three works. And then like, okay, now you understand the structure. Okay, here are, now we'll play with the unique card effects. Depends on how willing. Some people don't like sort of having an easy mode, but I found that helpful.
So I was just going to ask, as someone who's played it a lot and knows the deck really well, you know, what do you think? Do you see it as a flaw of the game that, you know, there are cards out there that can be pretty devastating if someone isn't aware of them. Do you highlight those, you know, up front if you're playing with someone who's, you know, not familiar with them? Do you think it's a game that's particularly prone to that, where, you know, deck knowledge is a big thing? I mean, I know there's games out there that people talk about how if you don't know what can come, then, you know, you're at such a disadvantage that it makes it hard to play. How do you feel about this game when it comes to that?
I think that can be disheartening. I had a game on Yukata where I basically jarred someone on like turn two and got lucky and took all four of their clay cards. That I took their entire hand, and that game just timed out. It was their first Matainai game. And I regret doing that. I just did it automatically. And then after like 2 weeks, I was like, looked at their profile. I was like, oh, that was their first game. I feel really bad for doing that. I think in an in-person game, though, I honestly just wouldn't, if I had the opportunity to play Frog or something or Shuriken, I just wouldn't do it. I would just smith another work. Just like warn them ahead of time. There's, you know, swinging cards, there's overpowered cards, but I would avoid playing them for a teaching game. Like it's 10, 15 minutes. The goal of the game is for them to understand it, not for me to win. So I do agree it can be a problem, but I just kind of sidestep it. And I still feel bad if that person ever came back to Matainai and played again and is listening to this. I apologize for ruining your first impression of the game.
Next time you have to lure them in with honey before you lay down the hammer.
It was just complete. I just guessed at random and got their entire hand.
Which I think speaks to the variance in terms of how contextually powerful a given card can be. Obviously, like in that example, maybe just won you the game, or at least like severely hampered them. Whereas maybe in another moment, a card like that might not be nearly as strong. And so I think that's another interesting little bit, but I am curious for you, Max. I think as a person who's probably, I mean, by far played this the most out of this group, what are some other potential flaws that you see? Obviously, I mean, I get a feeling it's maybe your favorite or one of your favorite games, so maybe there's not a ton of personal flaws that you feel with it. But before we kind of move on, maybe we've already highlighted them. I don't know if there's anything else you want to talk about in terms of like what might be some shortcomings of this game for others.
So the box says 2 to 5. I love it at 2, and it's interesting at 3, but I wouldn't play it at 4 or 5. It's just so chaotic. And I really like having each card being unique. And at 4 or 5, you play with 2 copies of the deck. And so that just sort of completely throws the calculus of, well, there's only one jar card out there. Like once that's accounted for, I can be safe. So that's not really a flaw to me because I just played at 2, but that would be something to be aware of. And then something, I don't know, this might be getting into strategy, but there's a somewhat common occurrence on, you know, turn 1 or turn 2 based on the initial flop into the, so you basically seed the floor with 4 cards in a 2-player game before anyone does any, or 2 cards, and then the first player puts one more card, and then the second player puts another card. So by the start of the second player's turn, there's 4 cards in the floor. And if someone can grab a Smith Helper on turn 1 or turn 2 without giving their opponents a Smith Helper or a Clay Helper, which is a pretty good counter to a Smith Helper, it feels a little bit lopsided. It's just kind of like luck of the draw that, oh, I'm second player. There's, 3 cloth cards and 1 metal card, and I have a monk card in my hand that I can play. And I get a really, really useful helper, and they get a not so useful helper most of the time. And it can kind of just make you feel like you're playing from behind from the very first turn. And it's a card game. There's always luck of the draw. It's very possible to just get a horrible hand where you can't smith anything, and your opponent has, you know, 5 metal cards and just goes to town with chopsticks and whatnot. So I don't know that it's a flaw and that something's wrong with the game. It's just part of the nature of the game being a card game, but it's something that I've run into people that house rule, like, oh, you don't let metal on the floor in those first four. You just put it on the bottom of the deck or shuffle it back in and draw another card. So there's no bet in those first four cards that hit the floor or something like that. So that's something that once you get a little more experience, maybe could start to bother some people depending on how you feel about playing from behind. Like sometimes I kind of enjoy it where it's like, oh, it's like a little handicap or just a challenge. Like, okay, how they definitely have an advantage, but you know, if you're clever and with a little bit of luck, you can, it's definitely possible to overcome it. It definitely makes you feel like you start off on the wrong foot.
So Max, one thing I was going to ask there, I think you may have just answered this, but I've definitely noticed that feeling in myself as well when I've started the game and then my card that I've tossed into the floor is not a Smith. And then or my opponent goes, they toss a Smith in and then they instantly help her up. And then I like feel super behind. And then I wondered personally, like, is that just sort of like a, like, you know, noob trap that I'm feeling behind, or like even a high level play, like, is that player definitely behind at that point? Or are like, you know, are there viable counter strategies, or like, is just one of those things and where you, like, yes, you're on the back foot, you know, deal with it.
You can definitely come back from that position. And if there is a clay card or a Potter card on the floor, it's very confusing. Each suit has sort of two names. It's either a type of worker or a type of material. So like cloth and tailor, Potter and clay. So if you can get a Potter helper, with the monk that your opponent played, and then if you have a Potter card or get one soon and you can play it before the floor gets crowded up and you can get, you know, two clays, or you can get, especially if you can get one monk and one tailor, or sorry, one stone and one cloth card in your craft bench. I would almost prefer being in that position, having the ability to craft those two suits, versus an opponent that has nothing in their craft bench, or say has paper in their craft bench, or they just prayed when you played played that Potter. So sorry, it's hard to describe that like level of detail.
So in that case, are you going for like a heavy back orders in game? Is that your goal there?
No, it's that's the possibility towards the end. But for me,
sure,
the ability to, you hamstring your opponent. They don't want to play, or they shouldn't be playing, a tailor card or a monk card, because you can get a work out of it. So it's something you can play you restrict them. They don't want to play those tasks, and you can play those tasks, especially tailor. If your opponent has five cards, a tailor's not that helpful for them. It gives them something, but if you can play a tailor and craft a cloth card, it's a huge advantage, especially if you can get a tailor helper and you can craft one and then actually tailor and fill your hand up again in the same turn. And it's a very good, so the extra Smith gives them the ability to build works much faster than you. But if you can fill up your craft bench, you can build works without enabling them to do the same. Whereas if they play a Smith, they're always going to be the off chance that you can build work. But if you play a tailor and they do not have cloth in their bench, they cannot craft a work. So it's just, it frees you up and it really restricts them.
And I do think, Daniel, I mean, I think there's no question that it's having the extra Smith helper is powerful. So I don't think it's a new mistake to feel, you know, like you're behind. But I do think something that became more apparent to me over time is how costly smithing can be. That it doesn't seem like that at the beginning. When you first start the game, it's the most obviously easy way to get cards into play as a work, because I think it's the easiest to understand. But there's a carrying cost to trying to smith cards, right? You have to keep cards in your hand, and sometimes those gum up your hand. And if you have a smith helper, which means that you basically get to take two smith actions, you might be trying to build up towards two works that you want to create, which is a lot of cards that you don't want to discard. And as a result, it ties your hand up and keeps you from potentially keeping other cards. It's not as efficient. If you have a bunch of cards in your craft bench, you can craft works without having to have other cards that you're holding on to that whole time. So I think one of the things the game does well is some of those seemingly really strong actions or works that you can get into play come with a subtle cost that wasn't as obvious to me at the beginning in terms of how much tempo and efficiency I lost to get to that point. So I do think the Smith Helper is really powerful, but it's not, you know, a death sentence in the game like it seemed to me, you know, for a long time.
So if you're going for like a really heavy smithing strategy, what you're saying is that you're bearing this cost of warping your hand basically to support that. And then your hand is where you draw your actions from in the future. So if you're not able to have a good spread of actions in your hand because you're trying to get enough, you know, brick or you know, whatever into your hand to build, then now you might be taking, you know, those very efficient smithing actions every, what, you know, 3 or 4 turns. But on those sort of off turns, you don't have the right choices, maybe? Is that what you're saying?
Yeah. I think that, I mean, you know, you're waiting around for the opportunity to make the best use of your smith action and the helper. And to do that, you need to have cards in your hand to support whatever work that you want to put into play. So, you know, if you have 2 works that you need to support, that's probably at least, you know, 3 cards out of your hand that you don't feel like you can get rid of, maybe 4, maybe all 5. And so what happens is every time you're drawing a card, you're passing up on opportunities. So there's this opportunity cost that's not obvious right off the bat. And it doesn't mean that would have been a better play to take some of those other cards, but I do think it can hamstring you when you get too tied to that. So I think what I was saying is that it is definitely an advantage early on to get that most of the time. But I don't think it's as heavy an advantage as it seemed to me early on.
I think there are 2 downsides. So related to your sort of hand management aspect is if you have a Smith Helper and your opponent does it, your opponent is not going to play Smith 95% of the time. So you're basically not going to be able to leech Smith actions off your opponent anymore. You have to draw those metal cards yourself, and you have to keep them in your hand, and that, you know, reduces your hand capacity to 4. And then once you actually smith, and if you're able to do 2 works, which is kind of your goal, you're down to 2 cards. So you started with 5, you played 1 as a task, you smith 2 more, you have 2 left, and you sort of open yourself up to you give your opponent some freedom when you only have 2 cards in hand. And then there are 2 catch-up cards, Shuriken and Frog, that especially in the early game when you don't really know what's out there, you know, you could really, it's tricky because the Smith encourages you, the helper encourages you to play aggressively and try and rush the ending. And that opens you up to Frog or Shuriken. And so it's almost like I have a Smith Helper, but I don't want to use it all the time because I'm going to reduce my hand so far where I have to just draw for 3 turns straight. Or I don't want to use it because I don't want to get 3 works ahead and let my opponent Smith Frog and or Shuriken me. There's only 2 really of those catch-up cards, I guess, maybe sort of. In a 54 card deck, and you might already know where they are at the beginning of the game, but there's that worry every time you're playing a Smith. It's like, if we're equal in works and I'm crafting 2 or smithing 2, I'm always going to be 2 ahead when they have a Smith to use and they can frog me or shuriken me.
I think the biggest advantage to having the Smith Helper is, you know, goes back to the nature of the game and that timing the end of the game is so valuable. So I think I find it less useful to be, you know, spamming the Smith task, you know, over and over again and trying to get works out, because you do run the risk of putting yourself in a position where you're, you know, vulnerable to some of those cards that Max was mentioning. But what it gives you is the ability to choose the end of the game, because the moment you get 3 works into play in one of your wings and you have a Smith Helper, you know, the other person knows at that point that, you know, you have the possibility of ending the game by putting 2 works into play, and it gives you that flexibility. And that's such a powerful advantage. So, you know, I think that's one of the reasons why it's undoubtedly helpful and probably, you know, an advantage to having that Smith Helper. But I mean, I think to segue a little bit, one of the things I was thinking of as you guys were talking about that is maybe just a little design element of the game that I've come to appreciate so much that ties into the hand management is the way that the timing and structure of the turns work you know, we talked a little bit at the beginning about how you have to discard down to five cards only at the beginning of your turn. So there's some interesting jockeying around how you have more cards in your hand off your turn and how you can use that, you know, to disincentivize what your opponent's doing. But what it means is that when you want to make use of a task on your turn, you are always going to get stuck with only four cards in your hand once you've taken that task, right? Because you discard down to five, then you select your task. So now you have four cards in hand. And then going back to, you know, the Smith action in particular, you're supporting a card that you want to create from your hand with other cards in your hand. So now you're taking one more card out of your hand and now you have three more, you know, to support it. So it's interesting. It can be really costly. And I think part of that is the, you know, there's a weird structure, I think, to people when they first start the game. It's very procedural in terms of when you do everything, but the procedure informs so much of the game and really adds a lot of interesting texture to the strategy, I think.
We have thoroughly segued into a deeper strategy discussion, which of course I am so for. So a lot of that had to do with a possible flaw that people would see in the game with there being that, you know, Smith helper at the very beginning, getting that early. Just to relate it back to where this all started. But yeah, I want to open the floor for some of this denser, more in the weeds strategy discussion, because that's really where the rubber meets the road in terms of these deep dives. I want to hear from you all as people that have played this game hundreds of times. So, I mean, we can really start anywhere, but maybe talking about specifically flexibility in this game as a theme, right? What are some things that you're doing in this game, decisions you're making to maintain that flexibility? When are you sacrificing that flexibility for the opportunity to do something powerful? When is that wise? When is that not wise, right? How does tempo figure into that? There's so many ways that you can take this, but I want to hear how maintaining flexibility or sacrificing it is a part of the strategy in this game.
Thinking about starting your turn, thinking about what can my opponent do? What do they want to do? And doing your best to position yourself so that when they do that, you can take advantage of it. Kind of going back to the Smith helper. If on, you know, the first turn, your opponent plays a Smith and they Smith like a meh work, it's like, that didn't seem worth risking a Smith so early. My immediate thought is, they have a monk and they want to scoop up that Smith that they just played on their next turn. What can I do to take advantage of that? It's like, okay, do I have maybe a Smith card and two paper cards in my hand, and I can use his Smith task to Smith something, play my Smith task to Smith something else. And then if he does play a monk, it's a low risk move if I can do it, because he only has three cards in hand. So he probably doesn't have something amazing to Smith, or he would have Smithed it the first time. And if he does play a monk on the next turn, there are two Smith cards on the floor for me to, he can have one and I can have the other. So just that they might just be playing aggressively, but just sort of seeing the possibilities and the sort of lines that your opponent might be thinking about, and trying to set yourself up to take advantage of that if at all possible, by getting something on the floor, or making sure you always have something to Smith in your hand, even when you're down to two cards. Like, there's something that you can do if they play a Smith, that kind of thing, where you're just, what are they going to do? What can I do to make sure, or give myself the best chance of doing something useful with what they're going to do? Especially thinking of it in terms of suits. I like to go, okay, well, if he plays this suit, there's five suits. So it's, if he prays, I'm thinking this. If he plays this suit, what can I do to take advantage of that? And making it so that, you know, four out of the five suits you can do something good with, and just hoping he doesn't have the fifth, or trying to get all five suits covered. It's like, I have something useful to do no matter what my opponent does, is like the ideal position to be in. It's hard to do that, but striving for that is my goal most of the time. I'm not thinking too long term. It's basically, what can I do to take advantage of what my opponent's doing in the next two turns?
I do want to unpack something you said, because I think it's interesting and subtle, and I'm curious what Daniel and Thomas think. I suspect Daniel already sort of thinks about this, but something you sort of threw out there offhand, I think, comes from just understanding the structure and flow of the cards really, really well, which is the idea that when someone plays something, you know, thinking ahead about how that card, you know, so the basic idea for people who don't know it quite as well is that when you choose a card from your hand and you play it as a task, at the beginning of your next turn, the first thing you're going to do is you're going to discard that task into the floor. And so now that card that you used as a task becomes available for other actions that scoop cards up from the floor. And so one of the things you did sort of without, you know, thinking is you saw someone take a task and considered, well, they might be doing that just because they want to get that card into the floor for a subsequent task, and then, you know, modifying your strategy based on that. And I think so knowing that card flow, the way the cards cycle in and around the different zones of the game, is, I think, a bit opaque for people at first, but is an example of all of the, you know, 100 tiny little things that inform decisions when you're playing the game. And I don't know, Thomas or Daniel, whether when you're playing or you're looking at it, you're sort of thinking of it in that way, or if that seems obvious and I'm just sort of talking about something that everyone gets right off the bat. It didn't come to me right away, probably.
I think that flows back into you talking about whoever it was that said this, but talking about the procedure and maybe not understanding that at first in terms of the rhyme or reason of that procedure, or at least understanding as a player how that procedure informs the flow or the sequence of actions or the sequence of events and how that impacts your decision-making. Because it's like, due to the procedural outline of a turn and a round or whatever, that isn't going to be relevant until the next time, right? Like, they're playing it as a task now. It's not going to go to the floor until their next turn, which means they also can't pick it up until the turn after that. Or I guess they can play the monk card or whatever to pick a helper that turn. So I guess like the next turn is the earliest that they could take that from the floor. But even just now, right, I'm failing to even really articulate that well, because it's like, it's hard to wrap your mind around even in those first like 10 or 15 plays of the game, which is right about where I'm at. Like, I have played this way fewer times than you all, but understanding the repercussions of a move that was maybe one or two turns ago. And so I definitely have not, I mean, I've grown a little bit in that ability to read that, but not anything major.
Yeah. So, the thing that triggers my mind, I guess. So one of my backgrounds as a gamer, is like semi-competitive Magic the Gathering player, which means I'm a deeply broken person. But also, like, you know, lots of sort of, you know, board game strategy things have to tie themselves back to those things, because it's also a deeply strategic game. And the thing that, like, you know, first sprung to mind when a match brought up that scenario is, like, you know, what do you think when your opponent does something that to you seems clearly not optimal, right? Like, you know, I'm playing a deck that my opponent knows I have counter spells in my deck, and they play a spell that, you know, I know that they know that I'm going to, like, you know, have a counter spell. Why would they do that? And the, like, you know, first instinct is to just be like, you know, counter spell, like, you know, counter spell right away, because that feels so good. But yes, you have to ask, like, you know, why would they do that? Why would they do something that seems to me to be not optimal? And then, like, you know, one, they probably have a reason, but then two, it goes back to that. I think it's also a thing Max said earlier about the mind games. Like, you know, are they banking on me knowing that they know that it's not optimal, or are they banking on me thinking, ah, he slipped up? And then it, you know, from like there, it spirals out of control. But, you know, back to this specific scenario, I remember, I think the first time I saw this in a Motainai was, my opponent played a clerk task, and this was fairly early game, not like the first turn or the second turn, I think. And like, you know, typically I think when I see that played, it's because, like, you know, they want to play out some some paperworks or whatever, but they essentially just played it for no effect. And I had no idea why, but it was that exact situation where they really wanted the following turn to get the clerk helper. And then they were just going to start sending works into their sales just, you know, constantly. And I guess if I had seen that coming a little bit better, I could have on my turn played a card that I wanted in my helpers, to like, you know, counter that, but I had no idea what they were doing. And so, yeah, I've definitely seen that. And like, you know, Thomas, I feel bad because I'm sure that was about 20 games in when I saw that. But yeah, I have definitely come into that situation. It's very cool.
Yeah, it's so interesting to hear some of these things, but I do want to bring it back again to the conversation around flexibility, because I don't know that I heard anything to this effect, but you know, we've talked a lot about maintaining that flexibility, right? Like keeping yourself in a flexible position so that you can adapt to whatever it is that your opponent is going to do. But there has to be situations in this game where you're going to have to sacrifice that flexibility, and not even just that, but where you're going to decide proactively to sacrifice that flexibility for a greater gain. So for those that are way more experienced in this game, when are you doing that? When are you limiting your options? Because that's a necessary step towards greater, in your mind at least, greater gains, you know, towards the mid or late game for whatever that is worth in a game that often is 20 minutes long.
Well, I think sometimes it's an example of knowing deliberately, you know, ending up with a small hand size because you want certain things in play and you're comfortable that you can come back from that. I mean, we talked early on, it's much harder to refill your hand in this game than Glory to Rome. So one of the types of cards, one of the card suits is the tailor, you know, the cloth cards, and they give you a tailor action that lets you refill your hand. And that becomes a lot more valuable to you as you start to realize how important it is to get right back up to, you know, your max hand size. So I think there's times when instead of keeping a lot of cards in play that would allow you to do more things on any given turn, you may decide that it's worthwhile to get a very specific combo of works into play that sort of complement each other really well, even though that's only going to leave you with maybe one card in hand or two cards in hand, which is a bad spot to be in the game. But, you know, you might feel like you're positioned to really quickly come back from that because that one card that you have is supported by one or more helpers. And so you might take a task just to get a bunch of prayers off of it. You know, you might not be able to take advantage of a particular task because you don't have other cards in your hand, but it's supported by helpers. And so you play that task just so you can draw 3, 4, 5 cards. So I know a friend of mine, I've played many, many games of this with. We had a series of, you know, 60 some games. He loved to get clerk helpers. And the reason he did that is because clerk, you know, the paper cards, that's the most common suit in the game. There's 12 of those out of the 54. And so he would build himself a little engine of those cards early on, which at first didn't seem that useful, but then he would just start cycling to basically build his hand and cycle through cards much faster than I could and give himself more flexibility. So it felt like an unorthodox strategy at first, but then we realized, wow, this is another really powerful way to use these cards. So I think that's an example of doing something that seems suboptimal at first. You know, maybe that's even who you played, Daniel. I don't know. But, you know, he loves to do that, and it's worked really well.
I think a lot of it has to do with the stage of the game that you're at. Like in the first couple turns, I'm a lot more likely to say, you know what, I'm going to try and go for a big, you know, a clay or a metal work, or because the chances of me being able to actually pull that off are so much greater. But you know, you're 8 turns in, it's like, okay, my opponent started doing things. I need to, if I haven't gotten it out now, it's just not going to happen. I just need to move on and just like tailor and just trash my whole hand and start over, or just being very aware because of that race element of like, okay, I have a couple turns I can play with here. It's not going to kill me if I waste 2 turns trying to get a really good combo and the payoff is good. But you have to be willing to abandon ship, because if you just hold on to that hope of getting something out, you know, 2 turns too long, your opponent can just leap ahead of you and you know, you're at two works and they're at five before you. And now you're like, oh, well, now I can do it. And I was like, oh, it's too late. The game's over. It doesn't matter. So just being aware of where the game's at and not just like, okay, I'm sticking with this. It's like, okay, I'll give it two turns. I'll give it three turns. And then I'm going to try something else. And being very willing to abandon your beautiful combo, because it's not beautiful if it's not actually in play.
It took me a long time to learn to let go sometimes and to pivot from cards or combos that worked well for me in one game, or, you know, or maybe more commonly someone just crushes me with some combo, you know, in one or more games. And then I think, okay, I want to get that into play. I'm going to try that. But they're so contextual that a combo or a card that's really good in one game, you know, may not be good in the other, or it may not be the right time. Like Max said, I mean, there's just, it's, you know, the, where you are in the arc of the game is a really important factor. You know, at the, towards the end of the game, you know, there's cards that are really good for filling up your tempo with lots of good stuff. If you get those into play early in the game, they're going to generate a lot of useful, you know, points or crafts in your craft bench. Those are really great. But if you try to put them in play later in the game, they're not, you don't have enough time to really benefit from them. So, you know, there's a certain point when you realize it's too late to really get the most out of this card, and it's probably time to get rid of it and pivot to something that's going to work a little bit more quickly for me once I get it into play.
Yeah. What, so you mentioned some cards and their contextual power, and I think that goes into something I wanted to ask, which is, what are some of those touchstone cards in this svelte 54 card deck, right? What are some cards that players should be aware of? Obviously, so much of that is emergent as you play. And so, you know, obviously, I don't think anyone would be listening to this, though, if they didn't want to know some, you know, pro tips, for lack of a better term, in terms of what cards to watch out for, when are they powerful, when are they not, right? We talk about, not like we as in this group before, but there's a lot of talk around something like a Twilight Struggle, where it's like, well, you really only need to know these 20 cards or something like that, right? The rest are, you know, kind of negligible. You can kind of, these are the cards that there's a lot of gravity around. And so I'm curious, in a game like Matai and I, where the deck is admittedly half the size, what do you think are some of those touchstone cards?
Well, I think some of the, I'll pick one and then others can chime in. I think one of the cards that Max was mentioning early that's a fun one is a card called Jar. And it's a card that if you, when you complete it, you pick a suit and then you get to take all of the cards of that suit that your opponent has in their hand, which is obviously strong in its own right. But something that I think is maybe a less obvious benefit of that card is the knowledge you get from it. Because when you read what the card actually says, they have to do this, they have to reveal everything in their hand. So even if you get nothing, you get to see everything in their hand. So you may take some cards from them, you may take a lot of cards from them, you may take only one card, but, you know, it's almost as important to know exactly what they have, because then now, until they cycle some of that stuff out, you can make really informed, powerful choices about what you're going to do that's going to benefit you and not them. That's a lot easier in online play, because the, you know, the implementation we all play tends to track a lot of that information. But when you're trying to play at a high level, you know, knowing what cards are in your opponent's hand that are, you know, not in the deck or still to be played is hugely valuable. So Jar is probably one of the most powerful cards, not just because of how it hurts them, but also because of the info it gives you.
I think this is a really tricky game to talk about without, if the people listening haven't played it, because the rules, they're a little finicky with how cards move around, but it's nothing too complicated. And the game is almost entirely in the text on each individual card. So it's really hard. Like, you can explain chess and then talk strategy. This, you explain the rules and then the actual game is played in the cards. But I think I've won games with every single card except Gong, where like this one card, even if it's only been one game out of, you know, 500 plus, is the card that won me the game. This unique ability turned the tide, and I was able to pull off some cool combo with it. There are, I don't know, 10, 15 cards that just seem kind of meh, but like in the right circumstances, they can be a total game changer. So we're talking more about the ones that just like in every game, like I mentioned Frog, I didn't say that it lets you, it's very thematic. It lets you take two turns in a row and leapfrog your opponent. So that's always, it lets you take two turns in a row if you have, after completing Frog, the same or fewer works than your opponent. So that's always relevant. You always need to sort of be aware of where is that card if it's not been revealed yet. Does my opponent, or am I willing to risk getting far ahead of my opponent in works? So like cards like Jar or Frog are sort of always relevant, but I think every single card is like, oh, in this particular circumstance, if he gets Socks out or Airplane or whatever, that's gonna kill me. Even though Plane 90% of the time it doesn't do anything, but it's like in this one game he's got three works on both sides. If he gets, and he's ahead, if he gets Plane out, he'll be able to win in one turn because he's got two Potter helpers or whatever it is.
The cards I think are really interesting because some of them I think are very situational, and sometimes you'll need the sort of perfect situation to make a certain card sort of work. And then some cards kind of create their own situations. Like in some games they're referred to as like build around cards, for example. My like all time favorite would probably be Bowl. It's a clay card. And then what it does is once you have it in play, at the beginning of each of your turns, you can take the top card of the deck and then add it to your craft bench. And that's essentially a free, kind of a free Potter action. You don't get to pick the card, but it's just a random card. But it's free every turn. And so that just feels very good. It just really appeals to that engine building part of my brain. And then there's also cards that I guess just like really turn on some other strategies I've seen. There's a different clay card in the match, probably knows what it is, but it's the one that makes it to where you get points for the most, or for you get points for each helper you have of your highest helper count, whether it's clerk or tailor or whatever.
Yeah, Hannibal.
Thank you. Yes. That card, I've used that card in the past when I don't play it right away, but I might try to helper a helper into my thing, and then just load up on clerks, which is good in its own right, whatever. But then my opponent thinks that I'm playing a sales based game, and they'll try and really deny me Potters. But I don't care about Potters at all. And then some cards, some works are really only good as sort of just either that in game reach to hit five, or they have some kind of in-game effect. One of the I was talking strategy about Agricola long time ago, and a really good player taught me a thing that when drafting your occupations, your minor improvements, a really tempting sort of thing to do is to be I can tell that the cards that I'm drafting lead themselves into a baking bread from grain strategy. So I'm going to gobble up all of the baking bread, cards, but that's not what you want to do. What you want to do is you want to make sure you have some good early game, some good mid game, and some good late game cards. And I feel like this game is sort of similar in that, you want to sort of know which of these cards you can build late and still that's good, and which of them really you need to sort of warp your entire game plan around.
Yeah, I think he Carl Chudik designs games that do this so well. It feels like he'll make a deck of cards where every card is broken, and somehow that all balances itself out. And I don't know how he does it. It sort of baffles me that you know, like Max said, every time you think a card is useless or when can you possibly use it, then you play some game where it feels like that's the card that was broken and overpowered and you couldn't do anything against it. And so to me, that's what kept me coming back, you know, to innovation. And then this game is that, you know, every time you played, you might find some new move or combo or card that you discovered that you never saw before. So, you know, I love that part of it. Well, I thought it might be just be interesting. So for those listening, they may or may not know. So Max organized a few, I think a couple tournaments now online on Yukata. So in the most recent one, he is the reigning champion. So he is officially the, you know, the best player among the four of us. So maybe we should pick his brain about what that means. What do you do when you're, you know, maybe when you look at your hand to start the game and as you're sort of thinking about what you want to do without, you know, getting, you know, too detailed, just big picture, you know, how are you thinking about the game and what you want to try and do over those first few turns and set yourself up? What's your opening strategy?
First, I just want to mention that you've cottoned on to why I haven't started up another tournament, because until I start another one, I'm the reigning champ. So my incentives are misaligned with everyone else's. But I think it's really tough. I like to play a lot of games at once, and it's really easy to just get caught in when you're playing online, especially async, and you just like log in and you've got 10 games going, to just like play by instinct and just bang, 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 go through them. But especially in a tournament setting, I really have to force myself to play deliberately. And I have like a checklist in my head of four things that I'm looking at. And then some subsets of four. I like things in checklists of four. It helps me remember. But I look at the floor and just sort of see what's there. I look at the deck. I'm especially looking at Frog, Jar, Shuriken, and Cloak. Those are always just sort of, in every game, those are impactful. I just want to know where those are, if they're accounted for or not. And then before I think about what I'm going to do, so I get a feel for just the general game state, and then I want to see what my opponent is, what his situation is, what's he got in his hand, how big is his hand, his works, what he has in his temple, which is helpers, sales material, and just sort of what options he has, and what I would want to do in that situation, or what I would be thinking when I played his previous turn if I was him, like, why would he do that? And then I look at my own hand, my own works and all of that. And then I think a key step too is like, okay, you looked at all these things, you come up with a plan, then go through the list again with that plan in mind and sort of see like, oh, I didn't think about this. This card's on the floor. Maybe that alters my willingness to play this task. So that iteration, just going through it, you know, two or three times, making sure that you're considering all aspects. I mean, it's super basic, but just having some kind of framework to look at, because it's really easy to be like, oh, I have this cool combo, I really want to get this out, and you totally forget that, that puts me three works ahead, several turns ago, you know, he revealed that he had Frog in his hand. I actually once played a game where my opponent played Jar and guessed metal and got two metal from me, including Shuriken. Later in that same game, I got two works ahead, and he played Shuriken against me and took one of my works. It's like, I knew he had Shuriken. I gave it to him, and I was just so eager to get this cool combo out. And then he immediately took half of that combo, and I, you know, lost the game a turn later, two turns later. It's really... In person, I like to play a lot faster. This might be segueing into the competitive play, and just sort of go for it and see what happens. But async, especially in like a tournament setting, as much as I enjoy playing quickly, my enjoyment is tempered when I lose to something dumb, like forgetting that I gave my opponent Shuriken, which is really easy to do because there's so many little factors. And the game state is not super intuitive on Yukata. Like, it all makes sense, but it doesn't necessarily jump out at you all the time when it's just represented instead of a card, it's just a little number, one/1 or something that means a lot, but is easy to overlook when you're playing quickly.
Speaking of slash one, so one of the things that we haven't really brought up is the concept of a helper or sale being covered. And I will try and give a super brief explanation. But basically, when you create a work in your temple, it goes either in the gift shop or the gallery, right? Those are the two places. And the gallery is the left, and at least that's how I think of it. That's right, right? Yeah. Okay. So the gallery. Wait, is that right? Oh my God. So the gallery is on the left, and that covers your helpers. So covers there means that each paper work you have in the gallery covers its value, which is one. Paper's value is one. Clay's value is three, so it would cover three different clay or potter helpers in this case. In the gift shop, they cover sales. Okay, so there's like two interesting things here, I think, is that one is that you can like split your works between the two and then sort of lengthen the game, which doesn't usually happen in games that I see. But one question that I have for you, Max, is like, what games do you put your works in the left versus in the right, in the gallery versus the gift shop? Like, how do you make that decision? So when you're like, you know, crafting your first work, that is a thing where I constantly am thinking, wow, I know there is a right answer here. And it's a 50-50 and I am going to get it wrong like 80% of the time. And so, you know, like, you help me out here. What is my thought process here?
I also struggle with this. This is one where if I'm not playing deliberately, it's very easy. I tend to default towards the gift shop. But there are many instances where it would be really nice to have a covered helper, especially early in the game. And if I'm not thinking about it, I just put it in the gift shop and I hit finish turn. And then while I'm thinking about what my opponent's going to do, I'm like, oh, wow, I really should have done that. I tend to, early in the game, if I have paper, I tend to put that in the gallery because getting a covered paper helper is really helpful throughout the entire game, because during the beginning of the game, you can craft or draw cards. And at the end of the game, you can move all your material into sales. So that's pretty much a default to putting one paper in the gallery and putting everything else in the gift shop, unless I have helpers. And then if I have helpers that I can cover and it's in, you know, the beginning of the game and it's not going to end in the next three or four turns, I'll put them over there. But it's can be really tough. It is one of those tension points, like the hand management, where it's just every, you know, at the beginning of the game, it's not too hard, but in the middle of the game, when once you have some helpers to cover and you might have a sale to cover, it can be a really tough decision. And I'm sure I mess it up half the time as well.
Yeah, it's definitely one of those tension points. And to me, at least, it feels so permanent, you know, like it feels like, whichever way I choose, that card is like, you know, stuck there. There's I think very few ways to get cards to move across. So it's a very interesting sort of tension point that, yeah, it keeps me thinking like, you know, oh, I'm definitely going to do this wrong. So yeah, thanks.
I think it's interesting because I think every decision in the game is informed by so much information, but you know, the nature of a card game is that there is hidden information and randomness. So I like that there's often no right answer or perfect answer. You can never know. You can make your best decision based on all this information that's out there if you know what to look for, and you can make a decision that's probably the best, you know, in that situation. But you know, you can look back and pinpoint often. You can go back and look at a game you lose and you can see like the exact time you made the wrong decision. And you know, a lot of those decisions are 50-50. I mean, you could come up with choices. And I don't think it's so much random as it depends on what it is you're trying to accomplish. And sometimes what you're trying to accomplish doesn't work out, you know, for a variety of reasons. You can make mistakes. But, you know, that decision, for example, you know, is a really hard one. I look at it as, what path am I trying to take, you know, early in the game? I look at my hand and I think, okay, you know, this task that I've put into play that's going to help me get this work that I'm choosing, which side of my temple I'm going to put on, that's going to go into the floor you know, where will this work help me when I potentially pick up that work from the floor in terms of it being a, you know, helper down the road or a good that I then want to sell. And, but you know, what happens is, like you said, you make the choice and then invariably one or two turns later, something happens and you're like, oh man, I really wish I'd put it in the other side. And I love that part of it.
Yeah. So I definitely try and, you know, think, what's my plan? And so tell me if I'm right in, like, you know, my thinking here. So my thoughts are I should cover my helpers if I think that I'm going to try to want to end the game quickly off of just like raw action economy, just I can get the materials or the cards to build works faster than my opponent. And I want to cover my sales if I think that I'm going to have more sales than my opponent. Like, is that sort of like the level one heuristic, or am I off there? What do you think, Max?
I think you could honestly argue both ways. So from one perspective, you want covered helpers in a game that is going to run longer because you will be able to use them more. But you're right in that if you have covered helpers, the game is going to end faster because you have more actions. So I honestly am not sure. I tend to just, or I'm much more willing to put a card in the gallery in the towards the beginning of the game, and towards the end of the game, I will unless I already have a majority of cards on the gallery, I will default towards the gift shop. It also really depends on the type of card. Like a covered Smith Helper, it's good, but I would much rather have the potential for covered Smith sales because they're worth so much. Whereas paper is not worth very much. So the opportunity cost of putting it as a helper is much lower than with something like a clay card or a metal card.
Right, that makes sense. And then when you cover one paper sale, that's a 1 point increase, right? But when you cover a clerk helper, you're like doubling the actions you get from that helper, I guess. Like, you know, maybe that's the way to think about it. And then, like, you know, what you said, I think made me think maybe this decision is not the sort of key integral part of my strategy that's making me lose all these games. Maybe it's like, you know, maybe it's not that I'm picking wrong. It's just that I need to pick and then sort of like, you know, pivot my strategy and like, you know, make that choice work the rest of the game, I guess. Right. Like, it's like, you know, maybe it's not that there was a correct choice. It's that, you know, maybe where does this stonework go? Well, I should just pick and then make that choice the right choice. So interesting.
Yeah, I think so. I said I default to like one paper in the gallery and everything else in the gift shop, but that's just a super simple heuristic to stop me from getting analysis paralysis. I don't know that it's necessarily the best strategy. And I think you made a really good point that, you know, once you have coverage of helpers, like your strategy will change and the value that you place on helpers will change. I don't know. It's a tough decision, but it's almost like so tough that I just abstract it out and just go with a rule of thumb unless there's something pressing. But I don't know that that's the best way to play. So
I think this speaks perfectly to just how much depth is here and also just the variability in the game state. And maybe the best players are the ones who read that, are certainly, not maybe, the ones who read that most effectively. And it's less about, it's still about, but less about any given decision and more about how you adapt to the decisions amongst both players and for example, a two-player game. That's the impression that I get. And that ability to pivot and that ability to read the game state and then have that heuristic built of, okay, this is probably what is valuable now rather than what was valuable two turns ago or what's valuable to me now personally and what I have in my hand or what I see on the floor. It seems like every turn is that puzzle And maybe when I'm thinking about something like innovation, which I hope that we'll get the chance to talk to eventually and do a deep dive on that as well, that one I always hear like, and have experienced like, oh, hammer the thing that you're like, you found the broken thing, hammer it, right? Do this until someone stops you. My impression with this game, and just from my own play, is A, it's much shorter, so there's just not as much opportunity for that, right? You're not going to get to hammer whatever the thing is a bunch of times. And also, the powers are a bit more discreet and circumstantial. Like, the powers in innovation are like circumstantial as well, but in here, like, the contextual part of it just seems even greater somehow with a shorter game and all that. So it's so interesting to hear. And that's why it's also really hard to, you know, I speak from not the person having to be on, put on the spot to do this, but like hard to evaluate this game strategically because it's so game state dependent. And to be fair, with a lot of these games we're going to cover on here, or that I will cover on here, that's true of them. But I think that's maybe the mark of a great game. And a game that rewards repeat play is because every board state, every, you know, set of pieces of information is going to be drastically different. And that's why it keeps you all coming back. But I think we've covered a lot there. So I just want to maybe get us towards the home stretch and kind of talk a bit about maybe some elements of that competitive play. And you know, we've talked about some of the tournaments that Max have organized. And I would assume that means playing this game at a bit of a higher level, you know, and even when you're playing casually, quote unquote, you're maybe playing people who have also played the game a lot. And so even that, there's a certain, maybe not stakes to that, but at least competitive value. And I'm curious, for those of you who've played this a lot more than I, has getting very experienced or good at the game kind of ruined, for lack of a better term, that like Matine as a casual experience? Like, do you still enjoy it in those contexts?
Yeah, I think I enjoy it, but in a different way. I think I enjoy showing it to people. You know, I love like when the light bulb turns on for someone. I'm not really going out of my way to play it, you know, optimally or to the best of my abilities, because it's not really fun to stomp someone who just doesn't have the same experience with the game. It's more fun to show them how much there is in the game and how much they can find to be interesting and inform their decisions. So I think when I play it casually, which, you know, is, I don't play it that often in person because it's a hard game to just, you know, toss on the table and teach and play out of the blue. But I've had a chance to teach a number of people. And, you know, when I do play it like that, it's something that's more about showing them what it's capable of. Versus when we play, you know, online, I mean, again, it just depends. Like the tourney, you know, it's funny how this arbitrary, completely meaningless competition suddenly changes the stakes in your mind and you approach it differently. I mean, I think everyone who participated in it has played, most of them have played a lot. And so one of the things I noticed that was a big difference was, you know, when I'm playing just casually with a friend that we had this series going for a long time, you know, RJ, who will actually listen to this, I'm sure, we tend to play, you know, a much more gambling, swashbuckling, aggressive sort of game because we just have fun playing that way. We like to take risks, make things happen. And then, you know, it doesn't always work out, but it's fun. In the tournament, you know, if the margin for error is so small, if I made a mistake or I did something that wasn't, you know, the right play, it just got punished like immediately. Yeah. You know, so you notice that people are so much more prepared. They're looking at everything. They're plotting out their turns. They're not moving too fast. They're taking a lot of, they're being very deliberate, like Max said, to check, you know, what's the information that's been revealed? You know, what do you have in your hand? You know, you're not going to slip anything past anyone. So it does feel, I think, like a deeper, more strategic, or, you know, it's very tactical, but very deep game, because you realize just, you know, the skill gap. I mean, I think, I don't know how many times Max and I have played, but I'm pretty sure he's beat me something like 2/3 of the times. So, you know, I know that if I make a mistake, he's probably somehow managed to put himself in a position to punish it pretty well. And so when I'm playing, that's in the back of my mind, like, hey, I need to be more careful. I have to sort of think through what I'm doing in a way that's more tense than if I'm just, you know, taking turns and playing more casually and see what happens.
I'm curious for you, Max, how is that going to hit you? It seems like you have maybe shown it to some people in person possibly, but also definitely play it very extensively online in a more competitive fashion.
Yes, it has. I agree with John that it's more enjoyable now in person when you're teaching somebody new. It's like taking somebody to one of your favorite restaurants or something, or, you know, of my favorite hiking spot. It's like, it's showing it off more than playing it. It's like, isn't this cool? Like this system. And one reason actually that I played so much online was that it was a game that was hard for me to play in person just because of the rules overhead. And so I was more willing to say, you know what, I'm just not give up on playing in person, but I'm just going to sort of assume that I'm not going to play this in person much anymore, because I rarely play it now. And so I'm sort of willing to give that up. Whereas a game like Innovation, which I also enjoy, I've probably played like, I don't know, 30 games online, because I actually play that in person. So it's like, I don't know if I want to play, you know, 500 games of this and memorize all the decks and then not be able to enjoy playing it casually with friends. So there's, I think you do give up a little bit if you're going to, you know, sink hundreds of games. You remove some of the exploration, like that if you play a game, you know, once a month for a year, you just sort of have this sort of ongoing, when you play it 100 times in a week, that's just really compressed. But for me personally, it's worth it because you get to just understand the game at a level that, you know, I've never played any other game more than probably 50 times, but I've played this like 650 times. So it's just like that being able to play on instinct and just knowing the cards backwards and forwards, you're giving up a little bit of that discovery for mastery, which the sort of the Tommy Spike archetypes, where you fall in that, I think will play a big part. But for me personally, just the opportunity to do that when I would never be able to play 500 games of this in person, was very exciting. And I really appreciate Watno putting so much work into implementing this and Innovation on Yukata, because the amount of work that goes into doing something like this has to be insane. So many possible interactions, so many cards.
And this is a just tremendous implementation too. So, like, you know, hats off. It's just been a joy to play the game on Yukata because the implementation is just so good. So yeah, you know, thank you so much. But I've definitely also seen this same thing, and sort of a similar thing to Max as well. Like my local friends that play these games with me are much more into the splashy, swingy, like, you know, Innovation, Glory to Rome style, as opposed to the Motenai style. And so I've just sort of, like, you know, partitioned off, you know, my gaming into where I play those games on the table with my friends, have some beers, you know, it's crazy. And then Motenai, that's like more of a thing that, you know, yeah, I sit down, I look at the board state, I think, you know, what's the play here? So it's, yeah, maybe different, like, you know, different atmospheres, different, different aims, different, like, you know, different feels.
I do think one of the things that's really nice for folks that are getting into the game is because it rewards so much repeat play, and because the games are short and there's such a good implementation for playing it online asynchronously, it's really fun to just have a series of games with the same person, you know, who's in the roughly same level as you, and sort of go, you know, back and forth and see how that develops. You see a little meta, you know, develop and then get broken, and then something else develops, and something that seems the strategy that each player is trying to do, you know, someone kind of finds a new one that counters it. You know, so RJ, who I mentioned, will probably be listening, you know, he and I played, I think, I don't know, 70 games, you know, sort of just back to back over the course of, I'm not sure how many months. And it was really neat because you could see this all evolve over time, and you could see us both getting better and kind of see how we learned and grew with it. So I think anyone who's interested in the game, you know, if you can find someone online, and the nice thing is there's so many people playing online on Yukata all the time, you can always find games, but it's really nice to just spin up a series with someone and you know, play you know, 10, 15, 20 times. You know, it's not something that's going to, it sounds like a lot of plays and a lot of games, but you know, these are things that you can take 2-3 minutes to do a turn here and there, and the games will end pretty quickly over time.
I think that's a huge plus. What you just mentioned, I used to play Through the Ages a lot on the app, and I eventually gave it up just because I would get bored because the games would go on for 3 weeks, playing async. But here it's usually you can get through one in a couple days if both people are checking in regularly. And that makes it so much more engaging to me, at least.
Yeah, you can see through the arc of a game within a quick enough fashion that perhaps you're internalizing those processes more so than a game that's going to be played over a month. You know, like I just played a asynchronous game of the old Prince 1871, an 18xx game, and a lot of it was my fault. I'm very poor with asynchronous discipline, if you will, but you end up not learning very much because it just took so long and you can't even really remember what the early game was. So when you can get it through a game in a couple of days like that, you have an idea still of the arc of the game. But that's really, once again, yeah, we've been doing great about just segueing into things, but I kind of want to move us into kind of a closing segment as we wrap this up. I think we've covered an immense amount of ground, and I love it. I'm so thankful for this group of people to get to talk about this really cool game. But we've already kind of mentioned, you know, maybe this will put someone onto the game. I don't know. Maybe they were crazy enough to click through this and listen to all effectively 2 hours of this conversation, or they just skip to the end. But for those that maybe don't have any experience with this game or very little experience with this game, maybe quickly, what are some tips that y'all have for those first 10 plays, right? Maybe just the first play and then like the first 10 plays. What are some little tips in terms of how can they enjoy this game more? Maybe that goes into a little bit of like early heuristics, building knowledge of the game, or just how can they teach it? You know, what are some tips that y'all have? If you can remember all the way back to your starting days with this game.
Well, I have taught it a number of times. I think I've gotten better at teaching it than the first few times I tried. And so I do think one thing that helps if you've learned it and you want to teach it to someone is when you set it up to teach it to them, you know, don't start from scratch. Set up a game almost like mid-game, you know, fill up a temple with, you know, helpers and craft materials in the bench and sales and works on both sides. So that way, when you're talking about each of the actions, you can sort of show exactly what those are on the board and where they move from zone to zone. I think, you know, one of the things that'll make the game more enjoyable and easier is early on, like Max said, don't worry too much about what the cards actually do. Just get a really good handle on the flow of the game and the flow of the cards and how they cycle in through the different zones of the game. And you know, you can play a few games where you don't, I mean, I think when I was learning it, I played a bunch of games sort of against myself just to try and understand what the heck was going on. And yeah, I didn't even look at what the cards did, really. I just played games until it became second nature to know where everything went and how it moved. And then that sequence was a lot easier. And then I was able to start actually paying attention to, well, why would I pick cards? Oh, it's because I want to move one thing from here to there. And I know how that works. And so, you know, it gave me something to kind of think, inform what I was doing that I didn't have when I first started the game.
Yeah, definitely agree there. I think it's, you know, really one of those games where you should like learn by doing the actions. And I'm not usually one of those people. I like to sit down and read the rule book and, you know, try to build the mental model. But I think this game might just be a little too opaque for that. Like, but then once you do start to say, oh, this is how the Potter action works, and this is how the Smith action works, the like individual actions, not that complicated. Like, you know, once you see each of them a few times, you'll figure it out. And I think you just have to sort of move the cards around, learn by doing, and it's not so bad.
And I don't want to oversell like the strategic, or it's more tactical or whatever, but that you don't have to take it super seriously and be like, oh, well, I need to check the deck every time to see where this card went. Tends to be more like serious and maybe chess-like than innovation, but it doesn't mean you can't play it casually, and especially when you're learning, and you know, just play it and sort of pull the levers and see what happens. And you know, enjoy the discovery of crazy combos and you know, unique sort of edge cases or non-obvious uses for cards. That to me was the funnest part, and it's almost like that you keep playing it, like looking for more of that, and it becomes subtler and subtler, but it's still there and it's still engaging. But those first big like realizations and the first time you get bowl and teapot both out at the same time is very enjoyable, and you don't have to think super deeply about it to get to that point of just like, oh, this is a cool combo, this is a fun game.
Absolutely. That's so cool to hear from individuals who have played this game a lot and to know that it A, holds up to that level of scrutiny and play, but also to know that, I mean, really with any of these games, but especially with a game like this that is so quick, is so easy to set up and take with you wherever you go, that it's something that can very much be enjoyed on a much more casual level, a level that I find myself in and on. So that's really reaffirming for those that maybe want to get into it, or for someone like myself who is not nearly down the rabbit hole to the extent that you all are, but is becoming more interested in that. So, well, cool. As far as where people can play this, obviously you can get yourself a physical copy. Last time I checked, it was still relatively available and was found even on something like Amazon. You can usually get it for like $15. Don't bother getting the deluxe edition the deluxe edition. That's basically just two decks of cards so that you can play it at more than three players. But as has already been stated, this whole panel of guests wouldn't really recommend it at anything more than three. And even at three, it's a little bit of a different experience. So don't feel like you need to get in on that at all. Just the mini version or whatever is probably where you want to be anyway. So that's where you can get it physically. Also, there is a TTS, a tabletop simulator module that you can check out. John and I have played on there a couple times and it works fine. Sometimes it gets a little finicky and glitchy, but definitely I would play on it even right now. And then also, as has been mentioned, it is available on Yukata to be played either live or asynchronously, which is how this panel of guests tends to enjoy it, just as a thing you kind of play as you go, take your turns slowly and things like that, which I can see being very enjoyable for a game like this where there's a board state to kind of puzzle out each turn. So for those that want to check it out, there's some ways that you can do that. But yes, that about does it for this episode, this deep dive on Mataini, this mysterious game that it is. Good Lord, there's so much to it. And it is very opaque, but hopefully those that listen to all of this enjoyed that deep dive. I know that I really enjoyed hearing from John and from Max and from Daniel about this game, and super excited for people to get to listen to this and maybe mine some of the depths of this game alongside these people. And maybe I'll pick something up from this episode. I know I did. But yeah, just wanted to say goodnight to you all for those listening, and hopefully you all join us on the next one.